clerk will call the docket.
Lily Kim against some John Bryan and Julie Ann Martin, Lisa Ann Campbell, Timothy J. McAvoy, Patrick J. McDonald for Kelly Sung John Bryan.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kimberly Murphy, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Lily Kim. Case comes before you today on basically a summary disposition of Ms. Kim's two of Ms. Kim's counts that were pending before the Fairfax County Circuit Court. And at this time, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Three, yes.
Ms. Kim filed a complaint that alleged, among other things, there were multiple counts in the complaint that she initially filed challenging the trust document that was allegedly executed by her deceased husband, Woojong Scott Kim. And in the course of that complaint, there were several other counts, but the one we're going to focus on is the undue influence count. She also filed a counterclaim in a cause of action that was filed by Brian Kim to establish the last will and testament of Woojong Scott Kim. In her counterclaim, she again alleged undue influence. On September 30th, Fairfax County Circuit Court, at a plea and bar demur hearing, dismissed the counterclaim that Ms. Kim had filed with respect to the undue influence in the execution of the will. Subsequent to that, by summary judgment motion, without a hearing, and I wanted to make sure that the court had, the record is complete, that is before you, there was no hearing on the summary judgment motion. Count seven of Ms. Kim's main complaint was also dismissed. And the basis of the dismissal was that, as a matter of law, Ms. Kim would never be able to establish that a direct, unique benefit was conferred upon the alleged...
Counsel, may I ask you this question?
Yes.
In a number of our cases, we've actually used the formulation, as your opposing counsel points out, that someone has to be a beneficiary. So how do you help us understand why that doesn't foreclose relief for your client?
Well, in a number of cases, actually, this court has used the term favorable. A transaction that is favorable, a will that is favorable, and the term favorable doesn't necessarily mean, as a matter of law, a beneficiary. So a favorable transaction can come into with a variety of things.
But one of the things that's striking about this case is there's no guarantee that Brian or his kids or whatever will actually get anything. It's certainly possible. But does that contingent aspect of the way this was set up cause any difficulty for your side, and why not?
Well, for starters, undue influence, the test that's been established by this court with the various elements, the main focus of that test is to show, or through indirect evidence, whether or not the volition of the testator was overcome by the will of the perpetrator. So this idea that this is a contingency, it's not really. He's vested with control that most of us don't have. As a testator, when we sit down to write a will, we are saying, I want this person to get this money, this person to get this, and it basically sets forth this entire disposition. I, as a person related to them, would never be able to come in and say, well, I would like you to give this property to this person, this property to this person.
But the point is that you're seeking a presumption of undue influence. You're not seeking simply to prove it in the old-fashioned way with evidence with the burden of proof on the plaintiff. You want to move the burden of production to the defendant. And as Justice McCullough just asked, we've never done that beyond the beneficiary status. And the question is, why should we, even if we had the authority to go beyond it?
Actually, because this is at the pleading stage, we're not asking for the presumption of anything. We've set forth the elements that are sufficient to be able to allow a prima facie case to go forward. In this case, Mr. Brian Kim was vested with the authority to decide who the heirs were, including
Can I interrupt
himself.
You again? I'm sorry. I mean, there's two questions. There's the presumption or no presumption. And then there's the old-fashioned, can you prove it, and did your pleadings have enough specificity to get you to trial? But put aside the second question for a moment. What authority do you have in Virginia that we should extend the presumption, which shifts the burden of production, to the other side, which is pretty rare in civil practice, to someone other than a beneficiary who stands to immediately gain?
Well, as this case just pointed out in Gelber versus Block, a decision that was rendered in June of this year, it reaffirmed or restated a rule that was within Parfit that said a transaction that's favorable. And we're looking at the favorability of the transaction in this case, the transaction being the procurement of a document that vests authority to decide the heirs.
But everyone who's accused of undue influence is doing it allegedly for their benefit. I mean, the exception swallows the rule if we say that, look, if you're trying to get something out of this with undue influence, we're going to shift the burden of production to the other side. Well, that's every case. Why would the presumption not, under that theory, take over the whole tort?
There's a number of things that are looked upon when you're looking at favorability. I think that's, we go back to Carter versus Williams, decided by this court, where the attorney put his wife in there. I mean, clearly the attorney didn't put himself in, but had his wife in there, and she was the direct beneficiary, he was the indirect beneficiary. I think the farther out from the favorability you go, yes, it loses the undue influence. But to say as a matter of law that unless you make yourself a direct beneficiary, you can go ahead and procure these documents. So that would allow a father...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's not what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that if you don't give the presumption, then the plaintiff simply has to prove undue influence with evidence as opposed to a legal presumption which eliminates the need for a prima facie showing of evidence.
Correct. They would have to put on... They even have to, even under this court's ruling in Whedon versus Whedon, you still have to put on the affirmative evidence of did... beyond the presumption, you have to show that with evidence that the will of the testator was overcome. I think that's always in the backdrop of any undue influence case. The presumptions just allow for the cases to move forward, but that's not where the inquiry begins or ends in an evidentiary hearing.
But to accept your theory, aren't we putting every estate plan that's executed with a family member as trustee in the position of being presumed a product of undue influence?
No. In this situation, Mr. Kim was actually the attorney who drafted the document. So he was the draftsman. It was executed 8 days before Mr. Kim's death. It was executed at a time when there was no discussion with anybody else, at least that's what Mrs. Kim has said. And also, too, looking at the documents. The document that was executed was a trust. It provided for lifetime distributions to him, lifetime when he lived 8 days. It misspells his stepdaughter's name, Cece. It's noted in Article 11, Section C, that it was spelled C-I-C-I, when in fact his stepdaughter's name is spelled S-I-S-I, is put in the complaint. It purports to give away real estate that was deeded tenants by the entireties to his wife. There are multiple difficulties with the document itself in the drafting that would suggest that something else happened, suspicious circumstances, surrounding the execution of these documents and putting this other individual in charge. And the primary problem in this whole situation is that she never even got to put on evidence to show all the other witnesses or other factors or anything to show that the volition of the testator or the grantor was overcome. It was simply decided you will never be able to produce any evidence as a matter of law because Mr. Kim was not the direct beneficiary. This also becomes a problem because what artful individuals can do is simply if they put somebody else in there and there's some language in there to allow them to distribute property as this trust does, you just wait out the statute of limitations. Well, it's contingent, so if we wait out the one-year period for an impeachment of a will or the I believe it's 2 years, although under some circumstances in the trust code it could be 6 months, to void a document that... Because of that discretionary power, you wait it out, then you can never claim. I mean, these are statutory principles, statute of limitations is an absolute defense. The other aspect of this was done on a plea and bar. A plea and bar that is, it was tantamount to a demur in that it just tested the sufficiency of the pleadings. And as I said, there was no hearing on the summary judgment, none of that. This was a very truncated set of proceedings that occurred between September 30th and ultimately on October 19th. All Lily Kim is asking for is the ability to be able to go forward with the evidence. If a jury or a judge ultimately decide that there was no undue influence, so be it. But there are multiple aspects of evidence that she's been cut off, essentially, from producing and putting forth to a trier of fact to show that, in fact, this set of documents were procured by undue influence. This was a gentleman who did not have a prior estate plan. So essentially, under that the laws of intestacy and course of descent in this jurisdiction, the wife, Lily, and Mr. Kim's two sons would share one-third to Lily, two-thirds to his children. And that's how the estate plan would have gone. There's no other evidence before this court. This is such a... What is unique about this case, unlike any of the other cases decided by this court on undue influence, is that there was testimony and evidence and subscribing witnesses, attorneys that were spoken to by the testator and the grantor, so many different aspects of evidence that this court could actually weigh and say, yes, this goes against it. No, it doesn't.
Could I ask you this? Suppose, hypothetically, that there was no presumption available, just for the purposes of my question, that there's no presumption shifting the burden of production to the other side, and that the preponderance is always on the plaintiff to not only plead but prove, okay? Under that assumption, is count 7, which is paragraphs 104 through 117, is that the sum total of the complaint, not the counterclaim? Is that the sum total of the allegations of undue influence?
Well, within the main complaint, there were other allegations. I mean, there were...
Of undue influence. Is that
yes.
the sole allegations of the claim of undue influence?
Yes, there were other paragraphs within the complaint that also spoke to it. They also spoke to Mr. Kim being the draftsman. They spoke to, certainly those paragraphs that you cited talked about his illness, where he was, what was going on. The documents were also attached
okay,
to the
so,
complaint.
So assuming every single word of those allegations, particularly paragraphs 104 through 117, are factually true, and strip off the conclusions of law, which is he's guilty of undue influence, what facts plead a prima facie case of undue influence with the absence of a presumption?
I believe that the facts that were pleaded were entirely within there. And if there was an insufficiency in the actual allegations or pleadings, because this court has also said we're not supposed to devolve into statements of evidence and the like, an amendment of the pleading should have been granted to allow the plaintiff, if she could, to allege more facts to provide a more reasoned statement. There was also an amplification. Bill of particulars could have been requested. It could have been granted. Those kinds of things to be sure that if this was the sum total, that your case has to be thrown out. And with that, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
You have 2 minutes and 24 seconds.
May it please the court, Tim McAvoy, Cameron McAvoy, Fairfax, Virginia, for the appellee, who goes by Brian Kim. There were questions posed, which I think are completely appropriate, about whether the court should abandon its line of cases, which culminate with Whedon v. Whedon, and require, or allow, I should say, something less than an allegation and proof that someone is a beneficiary before you can proceed to try to impeach a plan that's testamentary in nature, and including a revocable trust. And in looking back on the history of the cases, which are largely set forth in that notebook at Appleby's table, we've seen cases where people were drunk, cases where six doctors said that someone was insane and incapable of making a will, and yet this court upheld or overturned trial courts that had set aside those plans.
Can I ask you this? Did the trial court appreciate the fact that the plaintiff, in theory, with the proper allegations and enough evidence, could still go forward on the undue influence claim in the absence of the benefit of a presumption?
Judge Mann correctly cut to the nub of this, I believe, which is that if you look at the plan in question in this case, there's no way that Brian Kim can ever be a beneficiary or his children can ever be a beneficiary unless at a future time he exercises discretion and gifts something to himself, which frankly is prohibited by the Virginia Uniform Trust Code, which is an important fact in this case, where we now see in modern times the marriage of this legislative act with our lawyers' laws that have developed to protect testators' intents. But to answer your question, Judge Mann said, until that happens, and unless that happens, what's wrong with this plan? And there is nothing wrong with this plan. That was his holding. And he was correct in that because
Seems to me that the judge assumed perhaps that the only way to proceed was if the presumption was in place. Am I reading his order and the recitation in the JA incorrectly?
We spoke to that issue in the brief a little bit. If your question is relating to this unique direct benefit issue, which I think is a red herring ultimately, because you can uphold the trial court any basis that's revealed by the record. And what's clearly revealed by the record is 400 years converging on this Whedon versus Whedon line of cases that require beneficiary status. Because at some point, this court does have to draw lines, and it has been a gatekeeper. It instructs trial courts on how to keep frivolous claims out, especially in the sensitive field of estate litigation. And being a beneficiary is critical. And what Judge Mann did in cutting to the quick was look at this document and say, there's nothing in here that, frankly, even says that Brian Kim or his children have an expectancy. They have potential expectancies. It's even more attenuated than an expectancy.
What do we do with the Carter case, where it was the wife who was actually the beneficiary?
Yes. The Carter case is clearly distinguishable, I believe, because this case will ultimately pivot on the question of whether a power of appointment alone, especially to a blood relative where it's clear from the document that blood relatives are largely to take, and where the Virginia Uniform Trust Code is in the background to protect against future misconduct. The Carter case is distinguishable because the attorney in that case and his wife were named, well, essentially as husband and wife, which we in Virginia recognize as one, but the wife with a clear relationship to the lawyer got this immediate benefit, if you will, a gift, or she was a beneficiary, whereas all of the potential Kim family members, Brian Kim and his children, the folks that the plaintiff in this case is afraid of, they don't even have that. They don't get anything now, no matter how you look at it, no matter how you interpret this document. It's impossible. A future act is required, and the General Assembly has provided now this broad net to say if a trustee behaves badly, you can bring an action.
But how would, suppose, I mean, many colleges now cost $60,000 a year, and Brian has two children, so 60,000 times four times two, that's a whole lot of money. And that's expressly authorized under this trust, right, that he can, for the education of his children, make certain awards, right? Am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely correct. And I think
on what basis would the plaintiff be able to set any of that aside because it falls within the terms of the trust?
Well, I think there. So you get an important issue, and there are two issues. One is the validity of the four corners of the document setting up a plan.
Right.
The next one, where we have authorized by law powers of appointment, and trustees who can't gift to themselves unless there's an ascertainable standard, and that's, I believe, 64.2776.81, if I'm not mistaken. So they can't behave badly as a matter of law, but if they give to their children, for example, then there's a difference between whether the original document is invalid and whether future conduct is a breach of duty. And to answer your question, a wise trustee, and I hope the opinion reflects this, but a wise trustee would seek aid and direction from the court saying, here's my power. Here's what I'd like to do, court. $60,000 a year to go to, University of California, out of state, or what have you, and get an order from the court allowing it. If they didn't, then clearly you have an opportunity to bring an action under the Virginia Uniform Trust Code.
Yeah, but I think you're mixing two different things. You're mixing one: is this will a nullity? Was the testator's intentionality completely overborne because of undue influence? And then the second question is, if it's not a nullity, if it actually is a legally enforceable document, how do the players on this will actually operate within the four corners, and what rules govern their behavior? What you're saying is, well, we can govern their behavior later if they break bad on us. But her point is, the whole thing is wrong because the testator didn't intend this to begin with, any of this,
well,
because his will is overborne. That's her allegation.
Yes, I understand. Well, it's a conclusory allegation, I think, to your earlier question.
Right, but I mean, my point is, your whole argument on brief that there are statutory and common law limitations on the fiduciary's express powers is all right. I just can't understand why it matters to what we're talking about.
Here's why I believe it matters, if you indulge me for one second. This court has the Lulofs versus Keith case, distinguishing between the law of contracts and the consideration that binds parties together in a now-present act where there's mutual consideration, you're glued to each other, there's going to be a breach of contract suit, versus sort of the gift-like nature of the testamentary world This court has, over the course of the history of this Commonwealth, created these two lines of cases where it's easier to, frankly, uphold an estate plan, and now we don't know if that's a measurable difference. It's clear it's a measurable difference. How much, I don't know. But it's easier to attack an estate plan than it is a commercial agreement. The other way around. And I think that this court has always hewed to that important distinction. And so this Whedon versus Whedon case, which has a rich history, it speaks to major beneficiaries. It speaks to beneficiaries. Martin versus Phillips, 235 Virginia at 528, it actually says, quote unquote, a close reading of our cases says that you have to be, you have to procure the will in your favor, and then it goes on to use in your favor as equivalent with the word beneficiary. This court has, on a stare decisis basis, created a long, long line of precedence that says, this is what you must do, plaintiff, if you're going to attack an estate plan. That Lily Kim has not done, and she cannot do, based on the structure of the documents. And that ultimately comes down to a point of law that this court will either agree with or disagree with. But I believe that there are a number of sound public policy reasons, including the distinction between the commercial and the distinction between the testamentary, it represents wise public policy, it represents good public policy, it represents clear standards for trial judges, it represents clear standards for trial lawyers, and when we think of chancellors, as we used to call them, being the protectors of the weak and people who are less fortunate, we still have an immense panoply of tools under the Whedon case. If you can't make the Whedon case, then you can't attack the document, and that's what happened here. But that doesn't mean now with the Uniform Trust Code that the plaintiff is out of remedy.
So you can't attack a will if you are not able to acquire the evidentiary presumption in your favor.
You can attack the will if you can, in good faith, allege a set of facts that create...
Okay, so the answer is then yes, you can attack a will in the absence of presumption. You just have to prove it the old-fashioned way.
Well, yes, sir, you have to plead it and prove it. But if part of the pleadings include a document that show that the alleged bad actor cannot possibly be a beneficiary in the present time, nor can his children be a beneficiary in the present time. The point of law is, does a mere power of appointment equal the beneficiary status demanded by Whedon versus Whedon?
Am I correct that Whedon and Lulos and that entire line of cases on which you rely, all, as I think Justice Kelsey just asked, depend on the presumption being established? They're all addressing whether the presumption shifted the burden of production.
They do speak to the presumption.
And so why are we discussing those cases in the context of this case if a party can proceed without a presumption, just proving innocence?
Well, yes, and I understand that question. In this case, that there is no direct evidence that's been pled that Brian Kim exercised undue influence. It is the conclusory case that I believe the earlier question went to, and I believe...
But to the court, to the extent the court focused on whether she pled he received a unique benefit, isn't that problematic for your case?
I don't think so, because I think the trial court, as we tried to explain in our papers, was getting at something else. And whatever it was getting at, it can be disregarded under this court's longstanding precedent that you can uphold the trial court on any basis that appears from the record. And what appears from the record, when you peel it back, is this requirement that you be a beneficiary, whether it's direct proof or a presumption. Brian Kim can never be a beneficiary, nor can his children, until some future point. And so by mashing the, by allowing the plaintiff and counter defendant to proceed without following...
Your argument would be the power of appointment is never, as a matter of law, capable of satisfying enough favorability for purposes of undue influence with or without the presumption. So that would mean, if the answer to that is yes, then that would mean you could truly have the will of a testator overborne, unquestionably overborne. But because the overborner, the overbearing person who overwhelmed the will of the testator is not getting the money to his children until after the will is probated and years later when he actually redirects the money, he can't ever be sued. I just don't know how that works.
Well, I don't know that I take that position. There was no objection, for example, on the basis that more discovery was needed in order to flesh out the case that you're describing.
I'm going to ask you, was there ever a motion to amend the complaint or the counterclaim to add additional allegations?
I have to, my colleague, Ms. Murphy, and I are close. I'd have to ask her to speak to that, but I don't believe so. So there was no objection lodged on that ground. That claim that you described was not alleged in the complaint. And I also think as we take every case, you know, obviously on the facts, if you look at this particular document, there are cases such as Gill versus Gill. And even the Kansas case, Crescent was the name of it, or maybe that's a Virginia case, but it's the Kansas case cited by the appellant. Those cases speak to a requirement for certain kinds of allegations and proof that just were not present in the complaint here or in front of Judge Mann.
I mean, there's two issues. One is, did this complaint, I mean, assuming that you don't have to be a direct beneficiary, did this complaint even plead itself into that theory?
No.
Without the benefit of the presumption? The second point is, have we drawn and should we draw that hard line that you have to be a direct beneficiary? And that's the part I'm struggling with, because I don't understand why you could give $480,000 to pay for college tuition for two children, and that you can't touch that, you can't set that aside, even when the will was overborne. But if you make yourself the direct beneficiary of $1,000 in the checking account, why, you can challenge that all day long.
Yeah.
Why would that line make sense?
I don't think that the beneficiary has to be as inflexible as I hope you're not hearing me to say that it has to be utterly inflexible. But what I am saying is that, and we look at the Carter versus Williams case, which is a good example of that. There you had a lawyer behaving badly, which I think always disturbs any court. And the Kansas case was similar. There was a lawyer behaving badly. Those are somewhat unusual facts in those two cases. But I would concede to you that you have to take every case on as you find it. But in this particular case, the nature of the document is such that Brian Kim and his children can never be a beneficiary as a matter of law. Any kind of beneficiary, unless this court wants to say that a power of appointment equals a benefit under all of its precedents sufficient to go forward, which means that all of our family lawyers are subject to undue influence cases merely by being the draftsperson and taking an executor's fee or a trustee's fee, which can't be the law. We can't have siblings and parents being subject to this kind of litigation just based on that status.
But there still has to be proof of undue influence.
There still has to be proof of
undue influence. I mean, so if we strip off the presumption, which is the, you know, sky is falling problem that you're identifying, if you strip off of the presumption and the plaintiff still has to prove that the will of the testator was manipulated or overborne or wiped out or whatever, then why wouldn't we want there to be liability heading in the direction of the person that did that and then redirected money to themselves or their family?
I would say that the point that alluded me earlier on Gill, because I'm almost out of time, but on Gill versus Gill, this court, like the Kansas court, has said there are certain types of relationships that are less suspicious, if you will. The spouse and husband, this court's never really quite spoken to that, but I believe that to be a truism too. Here we have two brothers, all within the family, and we had a document that I've described now ad nauseum, so I won't do it again, especially with 7 seconds left. But you take every case as you find it, and this case, they didn't say that they needed more discovery when Judge Mann ruled in order to make the point that you're making. And they had their opportunity, and they didn't follow up on it. So we have a deficient pleading. We have a reasoned ruling by Judge Mann based on a document which I've argued now a lot, and we didn't have a request for discovery, and the gavel fell, and that's where we are, and that's what makes this case different.
All right, your time has expired. Rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. On the issue of whether or not discovery was requested or an amendment was requested, the court actually ruled on whether an amendment could actually be had at Appendix 401. It's the last three sentences. It says, the court ruled that Lely could not change the will or trust, and thus amendment of her pleadings would be futile. Furthermore, as to this issue of whether or not discovery was requested, there was no hearing on the motion for summary judgment. The summary judgment was filed, and the judge had entered an order saying that it was granted. There's nothing in the record, and there will not be anything in the record because there was no such hearing.
This was a plea and bar.
There was a plea and bar and then a subsequent motion for summary judgment. The plea and bar spoke to Lely Kim's counterclaim, and the summary judgment actually spoke to count 7 of the main complaint. There was no hearing at all on the motion for summary judgment.
Did you request one?
We were not given anything. Unfortunately, the record doesn't show. There was actually a meeting in chambers, and the judge says, I'm granting the motion for summary judgment. File your motion. I'm granting it on the same basis. There is nothing in the record because it's not recorded anywhere in the court's record. There was a subsequent issue with the entry of the order. There was an order entered on October 12th, which was entered by the wrong judge. And that's why the proceeding on October 19th took place. You have the transcript from that proceeding where the judge is entering the order and just voiding the prior order. This was an extremely truncated set of proceedings.
Can I ask you this last question?
Yes.
But correct me if I'm wrong. As I read your assignments of error, I don't see you getting at the point we've been talking about most of the hearing, which is, are your pleadings sufficient to even state factually a prima facie case of undue influence absent the benefit of a presumption? And if you can address where your pleadings plead facts, not conclusions of law or summary statements, that would, if true, permit a fact finder to find undue influence, that would be very helpful.
Paragraphs 22 and 23, talking about when the actual documents were drafted. Paragraph 23 says that Brian Kim drafted the trust.
You may answer the question.
There's also allegations that Brian Kim is an attorney licensed to practice in Maryland. And then, of course, all of the issues with the specific pieces of property that were tenants by the entireties that were also, those allegations, while not clearly stated, as these are all in support of, count 7 realleges all of the prior paragraphs from the prior counts. And count 7 actually says, hereby incorporates paragraphs 1 to 102 as if fully restated, which also incorporates all of the exhibits.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.